You are listening to the Ivy Podcast. Learn from the thought leaders in areas of strategy, innovation, negotiation, and all things leadership. We interview the Ivy League, Fortune 100, and top startups. Now, here's your host, John Carcy-Baev.
My name is Steve Cohn. I'm the president of Affinity Executive Search and the creator of Job Juncture.
Thanks, Steve. I really appreciate you finding time to join us on the Ivy Podcast today. Can you tell us a little bit more about Affinity Search? What problem are you guys solving with your products and services?
Sure, no problem. I started out as a typical contingency search firm, occasionally did a little bit of retained work. I began the business in 1989, so now it's 31 years that I've been at it. And along the way, we suffered from all the problems that all the recruiters endure every now and then from time to time, such as our treasured clients being acquired by other companies who then have their own recruiters that they work with no longer needing us. We, of course, wasted money on ineffective advertising, could never really use the database that we had acquired or built up, I should say, properly for networking and for making new placements. Always trouble finding the right talent fast enough. Very often having a really talented person emerge, but having no place to put them. Wishing that we knew what all of our colleagues' jobs were so that our candidates could be considered for them and be submitted efficiently. Finding a way to monetize our candidate flow in a way that could add value to them, perhaps helping candidates improve their resumes without costing too much time, efficiently giving top-notch interview coaching, trying to find a way to make other recruiters aware of our jobs so that we could use their candidates to fill the search before our competition even got off the ground. These are the typical problems that every recruiter faces all the time. You have to have exactly the right person at exactly the right time, and you can't use them for anything else. So over the course of the last 6 years, I put in place some technological help and some personal methods that solved every single one of those problems. And now, as a result of it, I have an operation that's still small in terms of human beings. I'm basically the only full-time person here still. But I'm able to fill jobs at a very, very fast pace. I'm making a placement on average every 4 to 5 days. I've had 58 this year so far. I had over 80 each of the previous 5 years. Our clients, of course, thankfully, are amazed at how fast I'm filling their positions. When we're filling the jobs of other recruiters, which is most of what I'm doing these days, again, we're filling them extremely fast, and they're very pleased. And the candidates who get the coaching that we provide are twice as likely to get hired as those who do not. I've actually been able to measure this. And so it's worked. I've been able to make the business everything that everyone, all the recruiters anyway, would hope that theirs could be. Mm-hmm. And solving the problems, again, the proof is in the pudding. I went from, again, being a typical recruiter who, like everyone else, has a goal to make a placement a month. To make a placement a month, you're a hero. You're making a great living. Mm-hmm. Now I'm making 6 to 7 placements a month instead. And so it's been wonderful. All that what if, would it really matter if we could do all these things? It matters.
Right. Absolutely. No, that's exciting. And congratulations on all your success. That's, you know, definitely some impressive numbers. And I'm curious, from your standpoint, you've been in this business for, you know, quite some time. You've probably seen all kinds of trends, all kinds of, you know, different technologies emerging, innovations and so forth. From your standpoint of where we are currently, especially in these unprecedented times as COVID, what are the most effective tools that staffing firms are not utilizing yet, probably should, in order to optimize their efficiency and delivery of better results for their clients?
Well, it's a different answer for smaller firms compared to larger firms, because smaller firms have different problems and resources than the larger ones do. In terms of things that affect everybody, before I get into details on what smaller versus larger firms can do, COVID, of course, has created an environment, a widespread environment of fear, loneliness, caution, tinged with a little bit of paranoia. It has not been an ideal time for either obtaining clients, really, or candidates, because candidates are very anxious about making geographical changes right now. And they're very anxious if they're considering a job that involves resigning from a position. They're concerned about, more concerned than average about making a bad choice. So the staffing firms that rely on advertising, cold calls, and obviously impersonal types of email campaigns, they're being ignored by everyone. They're being ignored by the clients and the candidates. And due to the loneliness factor, the job seekers who were previously content with an impersonal recruiter relationship now crave the personal relationship. I know that before COVID hit, calling prospective candidates on the phone was a complete waste of time. They would never answer the phone. If I wanted to get their attention, I'd have to text them or use social media to contact them. They would typically ignore phone calls. They would ignore emails. Now I dial the phone. They pick it up. They want somebody to talk to. So it's a great opportunity to be able to establish a rapport with not only job seekers, but potential clients. Because again, they want someone to talk to. And in doing so, they're sort of shouting out that they want somebody who's going to empathize with them, because all the phone calls, half of them end up being the same thing, talking about how the current situation has affected you and your personal life and your loved ones, what you think about the disease, what you think about the political responses to it. It's all personal stuff. But then that rapport is established and they feel comfortable moving forward with you, either to helping fill their searches or to maybe trust you a little bit and giving them advice and guidance on their own job search. Most of the time, I can't really help them on their job search, but they, just by having someone to talk to, I know that I'm planting seeds later for a relationship to blossom, because I know a certain percentage of them are going to remember the time that I gave them and the kindness I extended, and my phone will ring later when they're in a position perhaps to hire or refer people or who knows what. So the data farmers and the RPOs, and especially the overseas hourly people who are culling LinkedIn profiles and stuff like that, they're being ignored by everybody. Ever since early March, I went through a period of about 8 weeks where I was getting literally 20 calls a day from RPOs wanting to work with me, because the corporate clients they were used to working with had gotten rid of them. So they were hoping that they'd get action from the recruiters. But the recruiters were getting fewer jobs to work, not more. And so they had nobody to talk to and no place to go. And they are quickly going out of business. So for anyone who's trying to make a living from their desk, ironically, the most effective tool in technology right now is the telephone. People did so many things to get away from the phone and optimize how to reach and communicate with large numbers of people. That now those methods have become much less effective. And the recruiters I know who are really crushing it have returned to the basics of smiling and dialing and establishing a personal connection with everyone. I have a recruiter friend who I know who as of recently has just been on such a tear. He's made something like 14 placements in the last 6 weeks. And I called him up and I said, how are you doing this? What kind of tools are you using? And he said, I got rid of everything. I'm using index cards and I'm calling people on the phone. It's like, he's not even using his database anymore. Right. He's calling people on the phone. They're giving him referrals and it's just like the 1980s all over again. And he's making a fortune right now.
And that makes sense. It just seems so simple, but in these times, like you said, everyone just overloading the use of technology, social media, and the texting and the emailing, I think that gets, it gets overwhelming for a lot of people. So that totally makes sense. What you're talking about, some of the basics.
It does. It's all impersonal. But when you do use those tools, you have to use them in a way that, again, invites your humanity into the picture. So the most effective low-cost tool to use is Calendly and other programs like that. If you're not familiar with that, that's a program where you contact someone by email, let's say, or LinkedIn or Facebook or whatever method you're contacting them by, and you send them a link inviting them to schedule phone time with you. And so, the candidates and clients who are receiving emails from people they don't know they're very dismissive of it ordinarily. But the moment you offer them a human being to speak with, their demeanor completely changes and they cooperate.
For sure.
So one of the most effective tools that I use as an expensive tool is LinkedIn Recruiter. And you can't go cheap with it. I buy the most expensive package that they have, and it gives me access to the information on who everybody is in the entire network. And when I want to communicate with people, I contact them in a personal manner, or at least what to them seems like a personal manner. Mm-hmm. Invite them to schedule some Calendly time, and I have an extremely high response rate because of that.
Right.
And Calendly costs almost nothing. The LinkedIn's about $9,000 a year. It's a bargain. So don't send this recording to LinkedIn, because if they increased my price, I would still pay it.
We'll keep it away from them.
The cheapest thing I do. Now, the other thing is, again, as far as effective tools for the bigger firms that do a lot of advertising, I have learned that none of the bigger firms that do their advertising have any idea how effective their advertising is. They do not measure at all what their cost per quality applicant is coming from any of the sites that they advertise at. They have no idea where their placements are coming from, and they have no idea from one site to another. I've never spoken to any of them who know what's going on.
Right.
So they don't know if and how an application from ZipRecruiter has a different value than one from Monster or CareerBuilder or Indeed or LinkedIn. And to me, that's the most important metric, because you make your money really from how you manage your expenses more than from what your billings are. If you bill $1 million and you spend $1 million, you're accomplishing nothing. If you bill $400,000 and spend $100,000, then you're doing a great thing. None of the companies know what these metrics are. We built our own ATS. It's a custom job where we're measuring every single thing that happens when job seekers come, and from the places they're coming from, so that I can tell you or anybody else at a moment's notice, not just what my cost per application is, because that's kind of meaningless if you don't know what the average quality is of the source that you're getting the candidates from. What really matters is what percentage of the applications that you're getting from each source tend to be viable enough applications to maybe consider interviewing or sending to the recruiter whose job it is, or to the client. So I'm measuring in real time, and I'm able to take from any time periods I want, what the effectiveness is of each site that I'm advertising at. And then I'm able to trace it back, of course, to my placements and my interviews. And so I know site by site, on a site by site basis where I'm advertising, exactly how many reasonable candidates it takes to get an interview and how many interviews it takes to make a placement and what the average placement is. And because I have a handle on those numbers, I'm able to know exactly what I should be investing and where. And if I didn't have that data, I wouldn't be profitable. I wouldn't be able to be in the business the way that I am. And none of the larger firms even know where to start to do this. So if I decided to become a consultant, I could probably make a decent living teaching them how to do it. But that's the most important tool that they're not using.
Right. No, that's, thanks for sharing that. A lot of great insights for both the smaller companies and the larger corporations. It makes sense. So just as a follow-up to the question that we just talked about, what staffing trends that you're currently analyzing and researching or in foresee that will come out as a result of current times? How do you think this will impact the industry, the staffing and recruiting industry in general?
Well, things will never be the same. But that being said, all recessions do pretty much follow the same patterns. But this one does come at an interesting time in our social history. If you flip back the clock 11 years to the Great Recession, that permanently changed behaviors on both the client and candidate side. And the current pandemic crisis is just amplifying those changes and not really introducing something very new. On the client side, people in hiring positions of authority were absolutely terrified of losing their jobs, because that they knew that there really wasn't one waiting for them. And so management became more focused on survival than success. Before 2009, a recruiter could call a company with a really talented candidate, but from a different industry, and have a reasonable hope that they might get interviewed by the hiring manager, and then his or her boss, and then hired. Now, that never, ever happens anymore. Hiring happens by a committee. There is an average of 4 interviews instead of 2. There's a psych test in almost all cases, a background check, a degree verification, and all because the focus is on making safe hires. This way, nobody can get blamed for a bad hire. And they also can't hire someone who's too talented, otherwise someone's job could be at risk because no one wants to hire someone who's good enough to replace them. So what they're really looking for are B-plus level candidates to hire in most cases. And the only people that hire A candidates are management individuals who are very secure in their jobs. Other than that, they're looking for the hire that is a safe hire. So if it goes well, they can take some of the credit. If it goes badly, they can say, well, look, we all decided this guy, this person, you know, met all the qualifications. We all interviewed them. The background checked out fine. You know, it's not my fault. These things happen. And that aversion to risk changed everything. On the candidate side, since 2009, they've been much more focused on how they live as opposed to what they earn. And nobody thinks that there's such a thing as a career path anymore or stability. They all know that the companies will make promises to them coming in hiring about what their career path would be, and that circumstances come to pass such that that really rarely happens. So they don't rely on it anymore. And an extra few thousand dollars, unless it's the few thousand that you're not paying your bills by, isn't really changing your life. If you're currently paying your bills, someone is offering you a $10,000 increase. It's got to do more than just put extra numbers in the bank for someone to be willing to do it. So for example, I have found that I've seen this actually happen. I had a situation in Chicago where I had a candidate who was making about $130,000 a year. He interviewed with my client who was offering him $140,000. Seemed like it should be a no-brainer, similar job and more money. And he turned us down to accept a job at $110,000 that let him work from home. And the 2 hours a day of commuting that this person wasn't going to do, which was going to add up to more time at home or more time at work or both or more sleep, whatever, was a quality of life advantage that was worth more to this person than $30,000 was worth. And that was before COVID. If people can have a situation where they're flexible of when they can come to work, if they could be off every other Friday, if they get extra paid time off, you know, a more generous vacation plan. This matters a lot more to a lot of people than the money actually does. And also what they're doing when they're not working. People used to be willing to sacrifice a few years living in a crummy location to advance their career. They're not willing to do that anymore because they don't have confidence that accepting another job is necessarily going to really advance their career. And they're viewing their career more as a string of gigs than as a career that's really developing. So most recruiters are not aware of how much this psychology has changed on both the hiring side and on the candidate side. And it's just getting now more deeply embedded as a result of COVID. So these patterns, they're human patterns. They're not data-related patterns. So all the new toys that come out with our technology, all these the new higher and higher tech and the AI and all this stuff, it's not helping people make more placements because you can't measure the – there's no metrics for – how do I put it? There's no way to quantify what it is that's causing people to make the decisions the way they're making their decisions right now. And again, this is why the RPOs are getting killed right now. And the hiring clients also very often don't understand the psychological needs of the candidates. And so they are less likely in general also to make offers that are really attractive to them. They always think it's just about the money, and it's not about the money. So what happens though is the RPOs, they're presenting candidates, and the data related recruiters are presenting candidates to the clients, and they're data points instead of human beings, and they're failing to be hired, and the hiring clients just can't figure out why they're not being successful with this. So as far as what trends are going to come out of this, we're going to lose between 50 and 60% of all solo recruiters between starting at the time 6 months ago and this time next year. Over 18 months, we're going to lose 50 to 60%. That is more than in a typical recession. In the last recession, we lost, I'd say, 40 to 45%. And in the ones before that one, it was averaging more like 30 to 35%. But here, we're definitely looking at half to 60%. Most of the recruiters that have been, the population of people that this will be mostly are the recruiters who have been doing this for 10 years or less. Because they're data dependent, and they did not pursue clients from diverse industries when the times were easier. So if they're in an industry that's suddenly deflated because of COVID and the current situation, they don't have a base of other types of clients to expand into or to grow from. And the cold calling for new clients is impossible because hiring managers and HR departments are getting bombarded with the endless onslaught of calls from the RPOs and from recruiters saying, I specialize in your industry, which we all know isn't true. Because if they were specializing in their industry, they would have heard from them before. So there's no way for a cold calling recruiter to stand out. So as a result of that, what we're seeing now is in membership inquiries to recruiter networks like the Top Echelon Network and NPA Worldwide are increasing. But that's entirely coming from recruiters who are desperate to have any searches to work. And they're willing to take searches from other recruiters that they'll get only half of a fee on if they find a candidate for, because that's better than the nothing that they're getting from their clients who are no longer hiring for them. But they are also, the recruiters who are joining these networks now and are willing to work on split placement business, they don't understand that they're not used to the experience of working split placements on the candidate side. So since they're not accustomed to this, they don't understand how they have to adapt their techniques to succeed by filling other recruiters' jobs. I guess just to give you an example of what I mean by that, when I'm presenting a candidate to my own client, and let's say I have an exclusive or I'm contained or retained in some way, so I can take the time to write up do a detailed interview and presentation and not be at risk of the candidate, let's say, emerging from somebody else quicker. You know, I can take the time and really interview the candidate deeply and get to know them and write up, you know, good detailed reports and give them to the client, and the client loves it. If you do that with recruiters, then you're working against your own self-interest, because while you're taking the time to give a really thorough presentation, the same candidate could answer an ad that, say, other recruiter placed or that a different recruiter has seen and quickly send it to the job order recruiter. And then you're out of luck for having been too thorough because it worked against your self-interest. I don't know if I'm making sense, but it becomes a common pitfall. So what you need to do when you're providing candidates to other recruiters is you have to start out minimalist. That first you provide the candidate to the recruiter and say, hey, you know, this person looks good. Would you be interested in me learning more about them? Then at that point, you've got your dibs on the individual, and the recruiter can tell you, yeah, you know, this one might have potential. And then you've got your placehold, and then you can be more thorough and it's not going to cost you. But a lot of recruiters don't understand how to work with other recruiters, and so a lot of them just aren't going to succeed in changing like this. The older recruiters who can retire will retire, and already are. I know so many of my long-term colleagues who have just said, enough of this, I'm done. And the younger ones are going to decide that this way of making a living is over, and they're going to fade away and find something else to do for a living. So the trend of success is going to be that the smart recruiters, before their clients ask for it, need to make themselves more indispensable to the clients that they have. They should offer money-saving plans like hourly or monthly fee deals, because those will create a barrier to competition, and they encourage more interaction between the recruiter and the client, which in turn deepens the stability of the relationship. Again, it becomes a significant barrier to entry and then competition. And it shows it creates an environment where the client feels as though the recruiter is in this with them. Mm-hmm. And that when we're going through these challenging times together, everyone wants to save money and everyone wants to preserve their ability to make money and preserve their profitability. And so the recruiters really need to truly partner more with their clients and make themselves more indispensable too by doing tasks maybe that they didn't do before.
So Steve, let me ask you this. When it comes to cost savings, especially in current times, what do you think what's stopping, for example, corporate talent acquisition or an employer who is looking to fill a particular position to focus directly on their own, direct search, and not engaging with the staffing recruiting agencies?
Well, that's a very good question. And the answer is that they always try to do it on their own. But what the corporate side does not understand about their own HR department is what motivates them. You see, I'm motivated to find somebody really good, really fast, because this is how I eat. An HR department, if they make the job too easy or seem too easy, then they're diminishing their value rather than enhancing their value. And then they become less secure rather than more secure, and more work can be thrown on them to a point that maybe they can't do it. So what the human resource, and I was talking to a sales rep at one of the big, I guess I probably shouldn't name who the company was, but it was a major job board. And they said to their corporate clients, they measure success based on how many applications they deliver. Now, to me, I care only about the quality applications. I measure success based on quality applications for the dollar. But on the corporate side, they care about how many applications they're getting, because they want to be able to say to their bosses, we got 2,000 resumes for this job, and I had to read every single one of them. And we used this tool and that tool, and I narrowed it down to about 20 that we actually started to interview with. And then ultimately I got it down to 10 that we gave to you, and you interviewed 5 and you hired one. And that way it seems like they had this really Herculean task that they took on and helped make happen. But what will happen in this recession, as happens in the previous ones too, is at some point on the hiring side, again, especially now when business is tougher, when the hiring client said, we need somebody right now who can do this, this, and this. The corporate HR departments aren't structured to do things that way. They want someone now, they got to call someone like me. They don't know how to change tracks. And they don't know how to talk to a candidate the way a professional recruiter talks to a candidate. It's a completely different thing. And you can tell just by looking at their job postings. All their job postings look like EEOC compliant documents. Instead of advertisements explaining to people why this is a great move for their life, they're just saying needs to be able to sit, stand here, lift over 50 pounds. Nobody looks at a job posting and says, oh, wow, this job says it requires that I need to be able to sit, stand, and hear. This is great. This is what I've been looking for. Nobody says that. It's ridiculous. But if somebody, finds out about this wonderful area that they can work in, or this fantastic technology that they're going to be working in, or, what the work environment is like, that's the stuff that's turning on and exciting job seekers. So the more that the corporate clients try to do things themselves, the more they fail. And they continually wonder why they've never been able to successfully eliminate the need for recruiters on the outside. And it's fine with me that they've never figured it out, but they're just not incentivizing their people in such a manner that it would actually cause the elimination of outside recruiters.
Right.
But it makes sense, because the HR generalist who's in the company, they're a functionary. They're an operational person. They want to be told what to do and then do it and get paid for it. They're not looking to do more and fill more jobs and add more value to the company. Mm-hmm. They're just looking to make their own role seem more indispensable.
That makes sense. That makes sense. And, definitely you provide some compelling examples in terms of the pros and cons and advantages and disadvantages. And, I'm sure there's different sides to that. So I appreciate the insight. Stephen, if we were to talk about, you know, take a different side of this from a job seeker candidate perspective, what recommendations do you have for them when it comes to effective job search or effective partnership with a recruiter? I've been on both sides. I've been the hiring manager. I've been on the recruiting side. I've been the candidate myself. So I have these different perspectives. I'm curious, you've been in that field as a professional. What, you know, case studies or actual examples can you provide that may help current job seekers to, you know, implement and improve their results when it comes to job search?
Okay. When you're dealing on the job seeker side, it is extremely difficult. And although I haven't been one myself in a long time, I made an oath when I started doing this that I would never forget what it's like to be on their side of the phone. It is seemingly hopeless until it's wonderful. It's a disaster until it works. And there's no middle ground. A lot of candidates desperately try to do things to follow advice that's being given by consultants that usually is very, very bad advice. The way to go about it, like if you contact a recruiter, I get emails every single day from people saying, if you're working on a search that I can be of help with, you know, please call and let me network with you.
Oh, for sure. And we get bombarded with emails from recruiters left and right, all kinds of positions, and it's just such a bad experience.
And I know they're not really offering me anything. They just want to get my attention. Or you'll get a candidate who will apply for 50 jobs that they're not qualified for because they hope that I'm going to notice their application and that a job that's not posted on my website is going to come to mind and the aha light's going to click on and I'm going to place them somewhere. This is what they're hoping is going to happen. And I don't blame them for hoping that's going to happen, but it's not going to happen. It doesn't work that way. What you need to do as a job seeker is you need to get the attention of the person who you think could hire you. That's what you need to do. And there are various ways of getting their attention. But first you need to get their attention as a human being and not as a potential referrer or as a potential hirer. So I'll give you an example. Let's suppose you're a mechanical engineer. Let's suppose you're a polymer chemist and you've done research work on making kidney stents, right? And you say, okay, I'm in a pretty precise kind of field. I'm not going to go from making kidney stents to doing chemical engineering in the oil industry. You know, no one's going to take somebody that's diverse. But you can contact somebody at a company that makes cardiac stents, and then either engage in a conversation, because people are there talking all the time, especially on LinkedIn and on Facebook. You look for people who are in conversations in an area that's of interest and expertise to you, and you just join the conversation. And hopefully you end up in a back and forth dialogue with the person, and then you make a connection request. And they start to get to know you as a human being. And then you can say, hey, you know, I noticed that you work for this company and you make cardiac stents. This is the type of work I really want to be involved in, and I have relevant experience, you know, on kidney stents. But truly, I don't know who the right person would be at your company to introduce myself, and I'm hoping that you could help me out with this. You just approach them as a human being, but with a relevant message. And I'm telling you, 9 times out of 10, when you ask for help from someone, they want to help you. And if you're reaching the right person, hooray, they'll say, hey, I'm the right person, you know, let's talk. And if you're not, then they tell you who to talk to. But then when they tell you who to talk to, you have a name to drop. And a warm introduction is a million times better than a cold introduction. So you need to do whatever it takes to stop being a piece of paper and start becoming a human being. And the more that you can engage with people to talk to them on the phone and communicate with them electronically, the better. The more human you are, the more forgiving they're going to be of what's missing in your resume. So on the hiring side, you've got to reach out to, again, the kind of individuals who either do what you do for a living or who would hire the people that do what you do for a living. Engage them, get to know them a bit, and then start to ask about networking and, you know, what you can do to get yourself involved. That's the most effective way. As far as an effective way to deal with a recruiter, the recruiters, for the most part, are being bombarded. When they're advertising, they're being bombarded with far too many applicants for each job than they can reasonably handle. And they're very quick to dismiss an applicant that does not appear to have exactly what they're looking for within the first 10 seconds of reading the resume. It's extremely valuable when a candidate applies for a job and then follows up either in that application or subsequent to the application with an email that goes line by line in the job description how they meet or exceed each of the qualifications that are required. That makes it easy for the overworked recruiter, and it makes them more likely to consider somebody they might have previously overlooked. This happens to me all the time. What I do here is every time I get an application, my software automatically sends a note to the candidate thanking them for their application and asking them to explain why they're the perfect person for this job. And it happens plenty of times that a candidate who I initially rejected because I just didn't see what I was looking for subsequently sends me an email explaining why they're right for the job, and I see that they're right. And then I present that information to the recruiter or the hiring client, where I'm doing what the candidate couldn't do at the first submission point, which was saying, here's the candidate and here's why they're right for your job. And that makes placements happen. Candidates should be careful to only apply for jobs that they are really and truly qualified for, and then explain it to the recruiter why they're really and truly qualified for it. And they should not assume that the recruiter understands what they do for a living. Because a lot of times a recruiter will take a search in a field that they don't fully understand yet. And they need the candidate to explain to them why they are right for that. So then the relieved recruiter can get a bit of an education and then can explain to their client why the candidate is right and then hopefully make a placement.
Mm-hmm.
So the follow-up is very important. The biggest complaint that I have as a recruiter from job seekers is that they make it very hard to engage the job seekers directly and personally because they are so unqualified for most of the jobs that they apply for. On average, I need, and this is a horrifying number that I'm about to give you, but on average, I need 2,000 applications to make a placement. So just contemplate what that means.
Right.
And I need, do you need me to stop talking while that rings?
No, you can keep going.
Okay. Now, on average, I need four or five interviews per hire to occur. So let's pretend they need five interviews for a hire to occur. This means that five people out of every 2,000, right, which is what? That's one out of 400, which is a quarter of a percent. It means 99.75% of people who apply for a job aren't a close enough match to even get an interview. And when they're hitting the recruiters with that much bad data, it's very easy for a good applicant to get lost in the midst of all that. And a lot of job seekers don't understand why recruiters don't get back to them, even if their application isn't on the money. That's the reason why. There's no way to tell 1,995 out of every 2,000 applicants why they weren't right for the job. They shouldn't have applied for it in the first place. So the job seekers, you're never going to get a job. You're never going to apply for a job you're not qualified for through a recruiter and get it. It's just never going to happen. And they should really stop doing that because, again, they hurt themselves and they hurt others by doing that.
Right, right, absolutely. Yeah, you know, it definitely it's pretty obvious when I hear or when I see kind of these requests from different types of recruiters in terms of the position that they trying to fill for. And unfortunately, a lot of times, you know, I get requests or LinkedIn messages trying to solicit, you know, me applying for a job that's nowhere near my qualifications. And that just tells me a lot of the, you know, recruiting companies use some type of bots or some automation that, you know, sends these messages, you know, in mass. And it's unfortunate because that then creates this perception of the recruiting kind of recruiting or staffing industry in general.
Well, it's true. But the thing is sometimes it's not as insidious or thoughtless as it seems. You know, when I take a job that I'm trying to work on, at this point, you know, I attracted 2.5 million visitors to my website last year. So I have a lot of candidates in my database. So if I have a job that comes up, like I had last week, I had a recruiter tell me that she needs her client needs to hire 100 loan processors in the Western U.S. for a mortgage company. And so I went into my own database and I keyword searched on the job title of mortgage or loan and processor. It seems straightforward enough. And I ended up with a list of almost 1,000 people in my database who's had that title. So I sent them all a campaign. I sent them all an email. It looked kind of personal, but still it was the result of a Boolean. And of course I had a certain number reply back saying, oh, the timing's perfect, I'm interested. I had others, of course, say, I've retired, you know, remove me from your database. I had a couple insult me because somehow a loan processor was in a previous title that they had, but it had been way back and they'd been out of that line of work for a long time. You kind of have to be, you can't be too precise because you don't know, it takes too much time to read through 1,000 people to try to guess who might be interested in a job right now, or decide even who's qualified. And then send the message. I could construct and execute the email campaign in less than 10 minutes. But to read 1,000 resumes would take me all day. You know what I'm saying? It would take more than a day, right? If I spend 10 seconds on a resume, right, it's 3,600 seconds in an hour. I guess it would take half a day if I actually didn't do anything other than read these resumes. But 10 seconds is nothing. So recruiters do have to Boolean in order to effectively do email campaigns, but they should do it with some wisdom and, you know, and hopefully when they miss, they don't miss too far. But a lot of it is not bots. A lot of it is just recruiters trying to effectively use their Boolean. But if they're not so good at Boolean searching, then of course they're going to get farther and farther from a properly qualified candidate pool.
Mm-hmm. Very interesting. And thanks for clarifying that. I'm sure there's a lot of different strategies and, you know, the companies deploy. So that's very interesting. Stephen, last but not least, I'm curious, what are you currently reading? And what is one book that you always recommend to others and why?
Just one book?
Yeah, I know. Oh, I'm sure you have multiple recommendations, but if there was one that you would, you know, you would have to pick. I know that's tough, but what could that be? I'm just curious.
That is a tough one. Well, actually, I do have one that I always recommend from a business perspective that people read. The most valuable book I ever read in my life for how to conduct business is called How to Talk So Children Will Listen and How to Listen So Children Will Talk.
Oh, I love that book. My wife gave me this a couple of months ago and I've been...
Are you serious?
I've been hooked. It's an outstanding recommendation.
Well, then you know the techniques that are in there in dealing with children about validating their feelings, right? The most basic thing, right? 100%. Someone's upset. You say, I understand why that would make you upset. That should make you upset. You know, and as soon as you validate their feelings, the level of upsetness that someone has goes way down because the one thing that they're really saying when they're really upset, more often than not, is I want you to acknowledge me. I want you to acknowledge my feelings and my humanity and that those feelings matter and that I matter. And that book has helped me. I haven't read it in so many years. But the knowledge that I took from that book, I applied to, at that time I was employed and I had a job. And I was working for somebody who was very regarded as an extremely tough person to work for because they screamed a lot. And I managed that person and that relationship from this parenting book. And I have used the words and the lessons in that book over and over and over again. In business. And now, even though you didn't ask, I'm going to give you the second book, though, which has not to do with business, but raising children. And that was a sales book called Greenlight Selling. And I found it useless for business, but very useful in talking to young children. Anyway, so that's how to talk to children and how to listen so children will talk. Mm-hmm. As far as what I'm reading, I guess it's not political to say what I'm reading because I could be revealed as a lefty or a righty for reading these. But I just finished John Bolton's book about what it was like to work in the Trump White House. And boy, was it interesting. That's all I can say. It was really interesting. I don't think reading that would change the opinions of any of the 15 to 20 undecided voters out there. But it definitely sheds a lot of really interesting light on what the day-to-day activity is like in that environment. And so obviously, since we're on the cusp of an election, I've been more interested in this type of stuff than usual. And so I read Bolton's book, and it was quite an interesting read.
I love it. And for our listeners, we'll make the titles and authors of these books available in the episode notes. Stephen, I can't thank you enough for all the information you shared with us today on the Ivy Podcast. It was very insightful. I personally learned quite a bit, and I'm definitely looking forward to reconnecting with you soon to host, you know, a further conversation so we can dive a little bit deeper in some of the case studies and examples of, you know, recruitment, staffing, and job search, because it's such a relevant topic, especially, you know, in this current market. And you know, I'm definitely looking forward to that. So really appreciate it, and hoping to reconnect with you soon.
Sounds good. Anytime. Thank you for your time. I appreciate it.
Thank you for listening to the Ivy Podcast. Be sure to subscribe to our RSS feed on ivypodcast.com and all major podcasting platforms like Spotify and iTunes. As always, if you enjoyed this podcast, please give us a rating on iTunes.